Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, AMD Radeon RX 500 series GPUs, Intel Optane SSD DC-P4800X. This is a beast of an Optane drive. Logitech's G413 backlit mechanical keyboard. Facebook wants you to type with your mind, and Nintendo's going to break your heart again. All that and more coming up on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 411, recorded April 20th, 2017. AMD Radeon RX 580 versus the world. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show. The name is bringing you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, most delightful, and yes, most fun-filled hardware news available in this universe or any known or unknown universe. I'm Patrick Norton. Joining me as always, Mr. Ryan Shrout. It's an exciting week. It's kind of a mellow week, but exciting.
It surprisingly got more busy as the week went forward. Actually, I just realized, I was looking through our show notes, and we did not have in there just at 2 o'clock local time here in the great Eastern time zone. Alan published his Intel Optane P4800X review. So if you want to slide that in there, speaking of screwing up our TD as we go on the fly, I figured that would be a good way to really get him back into the flow of things. But
our technical director, the man that's switching the video and audio, whether you're listening or watching on video, has been kind of at a management level, hasn't really been working our podcast for a while. And he asked us to be gentle because he hasn't been working the board in a while. And Ryan and I promise to be nothing but organized and easy to follow talent.
Clearly.
Oh, boy. Before I slide in the Optane article, let's talk about the big news this week in GPUs comes from AMD. If you're cranky, you'll call it a rebranding, although I think it's a little bit more than a rebranding, especially compared to AMD's efforts in the past. But we are talking about the Radeon RX 500 series. Ryan went unhinged on an RX 580 8GB card. This is not, as we love to say, the fastest GPU ever. And AMD made that really clear.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing.
Go ahead. I mean, no, it's not a bad thing. As long as you're setting your expectations at the proper level, everything should be fine. I think it's fair to say that the RX 500 series 580, 570, 560 is pretty close to a rebrand of the 480, 470, 460. There's a little bit more. It's not a simple rebadge, but there is a little bit more involved in it. But what it is not is it is not Vega. It is not a new GPU. It is not fundamentally technologically different from what existed with Polaris in the first iteration, right? So you still have the same core counts. You still have the same memory bus width. You still have the same, you know, it's still 2,304 stream processors, 144 texture units, 32 ROPs, 4 gig and 8 gig capacities available, 8 gigahertz memory, 256-bit interface, 256 gigabytes per second available. Like, all of those specs remain the same. The only thing that changes spec-wise is the rated clock speeds go up on the 580 versus the 480.
So you get a magnificent, huge boost in performance over the 480
Of 80 megahertz, which is not what I would consider to be a magnificent boost. It is 5.8% as I bring up the calculator on my laptop. So you're getting out of the box a 5% increase in clock speed. And in theory, you should be able to run at the higher boost rates a little bit longer than and more consistently than in the previous generation. Also, because the only other thing that has changed is kind of the TDP and the power structure on these cards. If you remember back to the RX 480, there was a bunch of stuff about it being 150-watt TDP card. But it never actually really ran as low as 150. It was always running a little bit more than that, and it had issues with power draw from the motherboard or the 6-pin power connector.
As somebody who was circling that car for a micro ITX build, a super tiny build with a 250-watt power supply, I was painfully aware that it was 150 watts until the part shipped, and then it was way beyond what had been expected. But the 580, they've, for the overclocked 580s, they are actually, is it 225 watts, 250 watts maximum?
So the reference performance is 185. Reference setting is 185 watts. But they put an 8-pin power connector on the card. So in theory, you have up to 225 watts for the add-in card vendor to kind of make changes and be a little bit more creative with their designs, if you want to call it that. For example, the MSI card that we got in for our testing is a little bit on the higher side, $250 price point. It used anywhere from 200 to 210 watts of power playing games at 2560 by 1440. So, you know, definitely if you just look at it in that respect, you're jumping from a card that was supposed to be 150 watts but never actually was and is now a 200 plus watt video card. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's not like, oh, we're not going to recommend this card because it uses more power than previous card or NVIDIA's options. But it is, it's worth noting just the difference, right? It's clear that AMD's mindset has shifted a little bit from we need to compete and make sure that we can prove we're a very power efficient architecture to, well, screw it. Let's just get as much performance as we can and compete at the performance per dollar metric instead. And, you know, they help themselves out a little bit in that way. But keeping in mind that, like, the GTX 1060 6-gigabyte card that we tested it against is using, like, 70 to 80 watts less power while gaming. That's a significant amount if you are building a small form factor system, as you were talking about.
Well, okay, so we've got a whole slate of new cards. The RX 550, which is, like, an $80. I'm replacing the onboard graphics in my machine. I need a simple, dedicated GPU you know, for a 4K home theater build, the RX 560, the RX 570, which may be kind of like the sweet spot for this series, then the RX 580 should be street price around $230 for the base stock version of the RX 580. How's the performance comparing with the 1060?
So in my testing, the 1060 was still faster, not by a huge amount. I would say on average 5 to 7%. There was one instance where it was significantly faster, 18 to 20%. And then there were a couple of instances where, you know, the AMD card was either tying or a couple of percent ahead. So it's closer than it was. The 580 makes up some of the difference between the 480 and the 1060, but not all of it. Mm-hmm. I would still give NVIDIA the advantage in terms of performance in that segment. And considering that, you know, the pricing is pretty much identical between the 580 and the 1060, obviously it's going to vary depending on the partner card and the overclock settings and the day of the week that you're purchasing and all that type of stuff. it's close enough that I would still give the edge of the 1060, but AMD has closed the gap, and that's all they really wanted to do. They're not trying to make the claim that the 580 is an upgrade for 480. They're not trying to make the claim that if you, you know, this is more for if you are still on a two-year-old video card, the 580 is now a better option than the 480. And it's true. They absolutely were able to achieve that by improving clock speeds, increasing clock speeds at the expense of power draw to make themselves slightly more competitive against the GeForce line.
And one of the things they point out in the press materials is that if you look at Steam Analytics, you're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of a half a billion gamers, 500 million gamers, that have cards that are more than 2 years old. You know, and, you know, people are barely... You know, the vast majority of gamers on Steam are barely using 1080p. They're not using 4K. They're not using 2560 by 1440, but they're 1080 and well below that in terms of the resolution they're playing at. So this is really sitting in the sweet spot of the GPU market, you know. And, you know, unlike the 480, you've got HEVC, H.265, 4K decoding. Well, let's talk about Radeon Chill at this point. Are you seeing any major gains in terms of, you know, reducing... I mean, we should probably just talk about what Radeon Chill is actually designed to do, which is lower the temperatures or the power consumption of the processor, right?
Yeah, so I'll be very upfront here. I have been told and kind of lectured on it several times. I have not spent very much time with it. You know, maybe 10, 20, 30 minutes with it. The idea of it is really interesting. It's supposed to reduce the use on the GPU depending on the activity going on in the game. Right, but it is a whitelist feature, meaning it has to be enabled on a per game basis. It's not kind of enabled globally, and it works in a way that, like, if the game detects that you're not hitting the keys or moving the mouse or firing a gun or whatever it happens to be in the game, mm-hmm. it will lower the rendered frame rate because nothing is changing on the screen or things aren't changing on the screen at any kind of pace that it should impact your experience, right? And then the idea is as soon as you hit W to walk forward, it ramps the GPU back up to its maximum clock speed. You're rendering at full frames. And the idea is that you can lower your average power consumption and GPU temperature while not adversely affecting the gaming experience, right? So the problems I have with it are that it's a whitelist feature. It's not global. And it's in the time I tested it with it, which was like the flagship game they were showing at the time, it worked fine. It worked perfectly well, and it lowers your average GPU clock, thus lowering your GPU temperature and increasing your power efficiency. But it's a fairly small subset of games, and if you're always moving, always doing something, it's never going to come into play, right? So it really comes down to your play style, the game itself, and what kind of things you're happy with in terms of the experience. Fundamentally, I have a difficult time believing that it can have zero effect on, frame variance and frame time and stutter and that type of stuff, because you are changing the clock speed of the GPU pretty quickly, pretty often. And we, even when the 480 initially launched, we saw, or no, it was the 480, it was like the 290X. When the 290X initially launched, we saw huge clock speed variations in it because of thermal constraints. And we saw increased variance in the frame times and, a little bit less smooth gameplay because of it. So I need to spend more time with it. I do not think it's the magic bullet that suddenly makes the RX 580 as power efficient or more power efficient or more power efficient enough to somehow compete with the GTX 1060. I don't think they're going to make up 50% of their power consumption or, whatever it is, across a wide range of games with that feature. It's neat. And if they can figure out a way to implement it in more games more of the time, that could be one of the things that helps address power consumption issues that they currently have.
This is good. Or at least I don't know. At least it's moving in the right direction. I like, I've got a chance to play around, with one of the 550s, and as a basic card, if you're looking, especially if you want to deal with trying to build up a 4K home theater PC. Little leading edge for that, but if you're buying a GPU or if you just want to get something that's a little bit better than GPU on your motherboard, they're nice cards.
Yeah.
One of the things that Hard OCP noticed or pointed out that in terms of VR performance, the 1060 spanked, I think was the word they used, the 580. But the reality is I don't think you want to do any kind of VR gaming on a 480, a 580, a 1060, and things are just starting to get comfortable when you get to a 1070 level.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that for VR, you always want to make sure you're over the edge of performance, right? You always want to make sure that you're not crossing into where reprojections and synthesized frames are occurring. And the 480, when it first launched, was the lowest priced card validated for VR. Driver improvements have kind of improved that a little bit. And so the 580 actually gets you another 5% on top of that. So it's going to be better in VR. It's just, is it, excuse the phrase, better enough to stay above the water, if you will, when it comes to the required frame rates necessary. So the 1060 is still better for that. It's I don't think that's going to change anytime. If you're looking to get into VR and you're building a new system, it kind of makes sense to go with that 1060 or maybe go up to a 1070 at this point because of the advancements in VR gaming that we've seen so far. If you have a 480 or you have a 580, you will be able to play VR games. So it's a much different performance discussion than with normal benchmarking.
Makes sense. Nice card, available now. Definitely targeted the AMD enthusiasts and the middle of the middle of the road. Weird story broke this week. A couple of weird stories broke this week. Not the Intel Optane SSD DCP 4800X, the Enterprise Crosspoint drive. Enterprise 3D Crosspoint or Optane, but one thing I had to bring in just to sort of tease you a little bit was that, you know, it looks like a Nintendo, your favorite company to call stupid, is going to launch in, Super Nintendo Entertainment System later this year after oh so abruptly cutting off the smash hit that was the classic that was basically not available for the vast majority of its brief shipping lifetime. Do you expect Nintendo to sell a metric ton of these, not even come close to fulfilling demand, and then cut it off before everybody who wants to buy one can buy one? Is this the trend forward in hardware?
I expect them to sell not a whole lot of them because they're not smart enough to make enough. I don't know. they have yet to prove their capability here. I don't know. I don't know what to say about this. Like, I hope they do it, and I hope there's enough, and I hope I could buy one for $70 or whatever it's supposed to be, as opposed to $170. That would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. But every time, something about the NES Classic that has to be it was a very popular product. I wanted to buy one. I couldn't buy one, and now all I really want to do is go the pirated route and emulate with a Raspberry Pi and not worry about it.
Right.
Like, oh, as it turns out, if you're not going to sell me the thing to do it, then I'm just going to make the thing to do it. And as it turns out, I can put 600 games and not 60 games in this machine and not even worry about it. Right. And so that's the mindset people are in. Yeah, exactly. More fun doing it.
It's kind of ridiculous when you think about that, they have this successful product, they drop this successful product. It's like the opposite of traditional console launch, where they undersupply the channel so they can say, the Xbox/PlayStation floor/whatever completely sold out. Demand is through the roof. It's obvious. We sold out. And then miraculously, boxes keep shipping week after week after week after that happens. I think it's, Nintendo's going their own way on that one. I'm also still trying to absorb... nice write-up by Nicole Leona Gadget from Facebook's F8 concert. Facebook's F8 presentations was Regina Dugan, who's the head of Building 8, which is kind of like Facebook's DARPA, if you will. And when I say that, I mean totally, because Regina Dugan was the head of Google's Advanced Technology and Projects Group and the 19th director of the United States Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And I would have loved to have been there, because apparently she walks out and says, what if you could type directly from your brain? And then demoed a rig where someone was typing with their brain 8 words per minute. And their goal, is to have a real-time silent speech system that can deliver 100 words per minute. So probably 5 times faster than you can type on your smartphone, she said. And it's interesting because from what she's saying, and I'm going to quote directly, your brain activity contains more information than what a word sounds like and how it's spelled. It also contains semantic information of what those words mean. I also discussed the idea that they will, they've been experimenting with devices that it's kind of like Braille on your skin, in the sense that you can listen to speech or words as they are sort of pressed into your skin. And they had 9 words that were available on that. They say you can learn in about an hour. They also, Dugan said, quote, you can think in Mandarin, but feel in Spanish. We are wired to communicate and connect, which is way far. I'm still stuck back at the idea of typing 100 words per minute with my mind. And the fact that that's coming from Facebook.
I thought about this. I never used voice to text services because it's too fast for me to be accurate. Does that make any sense? Even if the voice to text was incredibly accurate, I couldn't parse my thoughts in proper English, well versed English, that would be then copied down correctly to a Word doc, whatever the hell I was writing to. And I feel like typing with my mind would be the same. I'm essentially verbalizing internally, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like, for me at least, when I'm doing actual writing, the act of writing and typing slows me down enough that I am a little bit better grammatically in terms of idea management and stuff like that. I could see it being super helpful for just applying to text and very simple things where you can just think it and think send. I don't know what that analog would be. For me, for like long form stuff, like I don't know how much this would help people who are like writing books, unless you do. I'm not one of the authors that does a lot of writing and then editing. I tend to do the editing as I go and then just say, well, that's good enough. But
well, it'll be interesting to see. I think my favorite quote from the event, our goal is to create, and this is Dugan again also, our goal is to create and ship new category-defining consumer products that are social first at scale. We can honor the intimacy of what's timeless and also create products that refuse to accept that false choice. The false choice being the idea that, they say now when you're interacting with people, you have to put your phone down. And she's saying, and it's very self-serving for Facebook, that, the world is now digital and physical and, you should always have your phone and, of course, be available for Facebook no matter what you're doing. So I just think it's curious with the idea that Facebook, I feel like this is just a total shot across the bow of Apple from Facebook. I'll be very, very curious to see what comes out of this over time. Very, very curious. Or slightly terrified, depending on the situation. or extremely terrified, depending on the situation. So, Alan has... So, Intel Optane SSD DC P4800X, 375 gigabyte, Enterprise 3D Crosspoint. We've been kind of following the Optane Crosspoint story for a long time now. And this is a pretty... insane piece of hardware. I don't even know how else to begin other than to say that this is a ridiculous beast of a storage device.
So I'm not going to try to sit here and be as technical as he could be in this discussion, but I would encourage everybody to go read this article about the P4800X SSD. So a couple of things to start with. It's an enterprise product. It is a very much targeted enterprise. It's incredibly expensive. It's $4 a gig. It's the 375 gigabyte model is what we tested. It's not flash. It's not NAND, right? So it's doing things from a technological and like a logistics standpoint on the chips that it's fundamentally different. And that fundamental difference allows things to go much faster. Now, the problem is software is still a thing. Operating systems still exist. And as you, there's a picture in the, first page of the article that looks at app to SSD IO read latency, and it kind of gives you an idea of how much of it is the software, the platform, the link, the SSD itself, and the non-volatile memory itself. And what you'll see is as stuff like, that one right there, as Optane has gotten faster, now those, like that red part of the software is a significant, about half, of the total latency for each individual IO. Right. So no matter if you look at that bottom line of that graph, no matter how low you get those blue colors, right, the NVMe read and transfer, you're not going to get rid of the yellow and the red. Right. So that's a different problem to deal with. And that's something that kind of permeates through this discussion about Optane memory and whatever form it comes in, is that we're still kind of at the mercy of Linux and Windows and the structures built around storage to kind of catch up to things. I will say that based on Alan's testing and his excitement for this, it is the fastest product he's ever tested. And that's by a significant amount. But we're not looking at throughput, right? It's only rated at 2 to 2.2 gigabytes per second throughput. And it is still a PCIe by 3 PCIe 3.0 by 4 NVMe product. So it interfaces with the machine like a normal SSD can do today. And it's not like the throughput is not fantastic, but what does matter is latency. So if you go to a page like
read responsiveness, QD1 average latency versus random write pressure. That's my personal favorite.
That's on the end. Yeah. I mean, so any of these will really do it. Yeah, that graph right there. So QDepth 1 is the most important for consumers, but it means a lot for the enterprise as well. And what's interesting here is this is the speed of reads being serviced by an SSD as you are writing randomly to the drive at the same time. And the blue line there is the P4800X, and the lower the line, the better. The left axis there is your average latency in milliseconds, right? So the green and the yellow line are the best enterprise SSDs from flash memory, the P3700 from Intel and the 9100 Max from Micron. And you can see that even at zero, at the start of this, the Intel P4800X is superior by a huge amount, right? 10 microseconds versus 84 versus 108 microseconds, right?
Yeah.
But as you begin to write to the drives, that latency spikes up very quickly on the other two flash-based SSDs, whereas on the Optane drive, it stays almost flat all the way through the entirety of the system. So even when you're writing 2 gigabytes per second to the SSD and then ask for a piece of data back, right? You're just getting what the responsiveness of a single read is.
Right.
The Optane drive can do that and service the read in 35 microseconds, essentially, whereas the P3700 can't do it at all, right? It stops at about anything over 1,000 megabytes per second. And the Micron drive stops at about 2,300 megabytes per second of writes, where it just suddenly can't do it anymore, or we can't measure it. So it's for an enterprise customer, this is a fundamental technological change for storage. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people that look at some of the initial specifications and claims that Intel made about Crosspoint, 3D Crosspoint. There's 1,000 times better endurance and 100x better performance. And really what we're seeing is about 10x better performance. But most of that is limited by the interfaces that we're going through, the NVMe, PCIe bus, and the right software that we have to deal with. Like, technologically, we believe that the hardware does live up to its claims. But because it has to go through an interface and it has to go through a software stack, built on, hard drives and floppy disks, things that have to change. If you go to the page that's called Bridging the Gap, there's an interesting set of slides that I'll just mention real briefly. The first graph in that thing that Alan created shows how big of a gap there was between on-processor storage or DRAM versus a 10K hard drive in terms of latency, right? And so it's a log scale at the bottom. So that gap is actually 100,000 times difference. Okay, so that's the speed difference to ask for one piece of data between a hard drive and memory. If you go down to three or four down, you'll see that we fill it in with SSDs. We fill it in with NVMe SSDs. And if you look at the last one in that set, you'll see there's a blue line in the middle that is now within 100 times of DRAM. And that, right there, the blue line is now 100 times from DRAM instead of 100,000. So we've made up a difference of 1,000x in that time span. And it's pretty impressive. And then if you go down to the very next one, you will see a green line input that represents a RAM disk, like the current best RAM disk software that exists. And that kind of shows you, in theory, if Optane could be installed in a DIMM slot today, which that is one of the form factors they wanted to have, like, that's as fast as it could go on current infrastructure that we have, right, today. And I think it'll get there sooner rather than later. So there's still a gap there between DRAM, but, if you look at that gap and how we've filled in the middle, it's really impressive to see what that is. And it's even... Again, it's sometimes for me, I look at these graphs and go, I've got to remember that the log scale. So every decade is is an order of magnitude difference. So worth noting. It's impressive stuff. But it's this drive, this 375 gig drive is like $1,500. Not meant for consumers. I guess if you could get your hands on one, you could do it. I don't know what your benefits would be yet. We have tested it with consumer workloads, but we're excited to try it.
I can imagine. Alan's just completely blown away by this drive. I'm completely blown away by the potential it has on the consumer desktop in the not entirely distant, but not entirely nearby future. So, yes. Let's say G14 mechanical backlit gaming keyboard. You guys had a write-up on PC Purr. We did a review of it on Tech Thing this week. This is the silver version, only available at Best Buy. And let me see if I can center that on there. We're using an exciting new interface for our recording. And not a bad price for a mechanical keyboard, $90. 1.5 total travel on the keys is like 3 millimeters, and they claim 1.5 millimeter actuation because it's really hard to measure 1.5 millimeters. The only thing I know of that has a shorter travel to actuation is Corsair's Rapid Fire keys and their high-end keyboards. 45 grams. I like the Romer G keys. Those are a Logitech thing, and they give you a nice mechanical feel. And as somebody who likes the loudest, clickiest keyboards, my wife was delighted that I was typing fast on this without making enough noise to wake up the entire neighborhood. Basic versions available everywhere is black on this one. Fantastic to type on. A big old mess of keys you can swap out that have sort of, they're contoured to hold your fingertips if you have difficulties with, the WASD keys. What was nice about the extra keys they put in the box, the contoured keys, is I could still type on them. It didn't actually make it more difficult to reach keys like I've seen with some of the more ridiculous gaming-specific keys for the board. Single color, not a lot of controls. You can basically turn the light up, turn the light down at whatever level you want in terms of the backlighting on this, or you can set it to a heartbeat pulse. The Logitech gaming software, that's the Romer G keys right there. They're nice, and according to Logitech, rated to something like 70 million keystrokes, which, automatically made me wonder, gosh, at what point do this key start to feel sloppy or start to get worn out? Can you feel the difference if you're a super gamer? Speaking of which, Logitech also claimed their keystroke signal processing is going to deliver you mad superiority on games such as Counter-Strike Global Offensive, depending on how the server registers keys being punched. What they're saying is, compared to like a Black Widow Chroma V2, you're going to, if you and the person with the Black Widow Chroma V2 magically hit your keys at the same time, your keystroke is going to get into the queue faster because it's only about 10 milliseconds total, which is way shorter than the Chroma V2. And, basically means you can fit in the nearest time slice for the controls on that one. I did not magically become a sniping madman in Counter-Strike Global Offensive after I plugged in the Logitech G413, but that's because I don't spend my entire life in Counter-Strike Global Offensive, number one. And number two, I do not have the reflexes of somebody half my age and never will again. Overall, though, I was impressed. Nice build quality. I like the keys. Romer G keys are nice. If you have to have clicky keys, they might not be loud enough for you, but a nice tactile response, 45 gram compression. Am I just nerding out a little too far on the keyboard?
No.
And I want to say, and the Logitech game software is nice. There's not a lot to do with this keyboard. It's simple. It's a little small, depending on your 1080p monitor. It scales up on some of the other monitors I tried it on. It was a little small, but it's nice, and they've been adding in some really nice overlay features and stuff. So if you want to completely nerd out and set your, basically manipulate your keyboard based on whatever it is you are doing in that particular game, it makes it fairly manageable to do. not my deep area of expertise. Mostly I like to figure out how fast I can type on it and if it gives me the sort of tactile response that I really, really appreciate on a keyboard. So, yeah.
I have that I'll keyboard stop. In the office as well, and I also like it. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Beautiful Crownfoot and MIDI ITX case from Dan Cases, the A4 SFX. I'm afraid to ask how much it costs because it's really pretty.
Well, the good news is I don't know how much it costs either. It's it was a crowdfunded, now very difficult to find chassis. Mm-hmm. It's part of the, it's one of the unfortunate things of those products that are actually crowdfunded, not by big corporations that then have this big budget to continue doing things. It was very much built, and then there was a run, and then it was hard to find out. If you go to the website now, it still lists Kickstarter, it lists Overclockers UK, and one other retailer, but nobody has anything in stock, and there's no real indication of when or if they get any more back in stock. And the one we got into review, go ahead.
I was going to say, it was about a $250 case on the Kickstarter originally.
Yes. I think that's right. And the reason we got one is a reader ordered one through Kickstarter, got it in, offered to send it to us to review before he actually built a system in it. So that's how we actually got a hold of one, is we didn't actually get one for review. It's if you like mini ITX stuff, this is amazing. And it's one of the more innovative designs we've seen, right? There's a lot of perforations on the side so that there's good airflow. Right. The motherboard and the graphics card are facing 180 degrees opposed from each other. They use like a ribbon cable and, you know, PCIe kind of extension to make that work. If you look, there's a shot, I think it's on the third page where it's an overhead. On the third page, you can see, you know, the SFX power supply, motherboard and cooler in a place. And then the next picture shows the video card taking up the whole other side. And then the third picture, the overhead, says or shows like that there's no more space for stuff in this chassis, right? Yeah, that one right there. Go up a little bit there. You can see the ribbon cables coming from the bottom of the motherboard to the video card. You can see the power supply in the upper right hand. Like, there's really nothing left to give in this type of design. But you still have,
as tight as the Mini S4 I built, but it's in the neighborhood.
You can get a full. Could you get a full size video card in that?
I want to say about 8.5 inches, but it was done doing a ribbon card that laid it over and
Pulled
it into the side of the case. That case.
So this is,
you know, about 2.5 inches.
It's SFX or SFXL power supply. It's a full size video card, but not 2.5 slots. It's still got to be a normal 2 slotter, and then the motherboard itself can be mini ITX, but you have a height limit of, I think, 48 millimeters on the cooler itself. So a pretty impressive design. You know, performance is pretty good. Sound levels are okay. You know, and it's not going to be built for performance, but it seems to perform fine. It is really like, how much compute can you get in as small a space as possible? And they did a pretty impressive job, and it's always good to see like innovative designs from the community like that.
Nice. I look forward to seeing what they might come up with next. Asus launched the Tinkerboard in the United States. And if I'm sounding a little surly, it may be because I am. I am completely overwhelmed with single board PCs. and I mean that in the best possible way. But this is essentially, it's a Raspberry Pi, it's an Odroid, ROC chip, RK3288, 4-ARM Cortex A17 CPU cores. Jeremy Hellstrom wrote this up at PC Per, running 1.8 gigahertz with a Mali T764 GPU at 600 megahertz, selling for about a little bit more than the expected price of $55, and they're going to run a Debian-based operating system called Asus Tinker OS. 40-pin GPIO header, 15-pin MIPI DSI, 15-pin MIPI CSI, 2-pin contact point for PWM or SPDIF signals, and eventually, excuse me, externally, 4 USB 2.0 ports, HDMI, 3.5 millimeter audio jack, There's a wired NIC, which I love, as well as 802.11bgn Wi-Fi, Bluetooth 4.0. It's a really nice, complete board, like a lot of, basically, if you could kind of say everything other than Raspberry Pi, you know, support for this. Like, it's something we've been saying for the last couple of years, is there are some amazing single board PCs. The advantage of the Raspberry Pi is if you are not elite Linux hacker, there is a lot of sort of, you know, easy to do stuff on a Raspberry Pi and a tremendous amount of documentation. Once you get into stuff like this, you will either need to find someone who is elite Linux hacker, or you will become elite Linux hacker in the process of making this do what you want it to do.
Finally.
So there's a sentence in there somewhere. And actually, you know, the other thing I thought was interesting came out this week. Lenovo's announcing a Flex 11 Chromebook, 2-in-1 convertible, 2.1 gigahertz quad-core ARM processor running Chrome OS, 11.6-inch multi-touch display. They're claiming up to 10 hours of battery life, weight under 3 pounds, price about $279. One of my favorite details, Sebastian picked up on this one, designed to be rugged with drop and liquid spill resistance, including a water-resistant keyboard up to one cup, with channels beneath the keyboard to drain liquid, keeping it away from sensitive electrical components, which is Lenovo's way of saying, we know what you do when you're using our devices, and we're going to try really hard to keep this one from dying, and I really, really appreciate that.
Nice.
So that's going to ship later in April. USB 3.0, USB Type-C, HDMI, microphone, audio jack, SD card slots, and hopefully we'll be playing, your Android software, if memory serves. So,
yeah, I've actually been messing around with that for the last week or so. Android apps on Chromebooks.
Which one?
It's pretty interesting. I have three. I have the Acer R11, Acer R13. One is Intel powered. One's ARM powered. And I just got in the Chromebook Plus, which is the Samsung powered by the OP1, which is an ARM processor as well.
Has there been a performance advantage in ARM versus Intel or Intel versus ARM?
That's what I'm trying to figure out right now. I would say initially all indications point that applications load much faster on the ARM machines, and the compatibility is much better on the ARM machines. Like a couple of games, like one of the games I was playing just like has total texture corruption on the Intel hardware. The Minecraft game doesn't get past the splash screen on the Intel hardware. There's some stuff like that that I think comes into play from like binary translation that doesn't matter for Chrome apps because they're web-based and it was kind of a different OS thing. And Intel, like Chrome OS was built knowing there was going to be Intel platforms on it, whereas Android is a totally different beast. So that's been my experience thus far before I finish all of my testing and whatnot, hopefully by the end of this week, which is tomorrow. Damn it. Okay. Soon.
Just give up sleep. Just have your sleep removed. Okay. Samsung Galaxy S8 review. Sorry. Samsung Galaxy S8 reviews, S8 Plus reviews started showing up this week. $720 at the low end of the S8, up to $850 at the high end with the S8 Plus. The kind of universal response is fit, finish, construction feels absolutely fantastic. Gorgeous 18.5 by 9 Infinity display, Quad HD, Super AMOLED screen, although some early examples that have shipped seem to have a tint to the screen that is not pleasing to the eye. Seen photos, haven't seen one in real life. The S8's got a 5.8-inch OLED. It's like 2960 by 1440, 570 pixels per inch, which is kind of over the top. The S8 Plus is a 6.2-inch OLED, 2960 by 1440. Again, 529 pixels per inch. The screens, people are saying, feel smaller. And I tend to agree. When you get into that stretched 18.5 by 9, well, right, they're trying to make the phone narrower and easier to use, and they end up making it longer. And the result is some of the stuff can be difficult to reach on the top of the screen if you are a single-hand phone user. The U.S. And some nations get Qualcomm Snapdragon 835, which is going to be running like 4 gigabytes of RAM, 64 or 128 gigabyte memory configurations. Most of the world gets Samsung's fairly similarly spec'd Exynos processor. Everybody says great camera, amazing build. The curved screen is matched by the curved back. On the downside, Bixby Assistant kind of sucks. They have a dedicated Bixby button on the side that you probably won't use for a while, if at all. The fingerprint scanner is way up in the back of the phone and up by the camera, which is not my favorite spot, but they had to put it there to make space for the battery. Nope, making space for the battery is good. Some folks are reporting that this face scanner doesn't work particularly well to unlock the phone. And, of course, several people reviewing and commenting on the Galaxy S8 have concerns about the battery because of the issue with the, you know, the phone with the flames and the fire that was a Samsung product. Samsung made it abundantly clear. Yeah, now you remember. It's a distinctive thing when you see a phone on fire. Mm-hmm. But the, Samsung says they have it sorted. That was a big part of their presentation or the launch for the S8. It was like, we got this. It's a feature, not a bug, not the flaming part, but all of the precautions they put in to help prevent that from happening again in the future. So go Samsung. And, you know, the other rumor that's floating around with people who pay attention to, you know, sort of volumes and stock prices is that the orders are a little bit higher than Samsung projected. So iPhone 8 rumors are speeding up. Not the iPhone 8. That was the Galaxy S8. It's a good-looking phone. It really is. Fall 2017, possibly as many as 3 new iPhones, 10-year anniversary, a flagship iPhone, expected features, 5.8-inch OLED display, A11 processor, glass body, which kind of scares me. Mac Rumors got a fantastic roundup on the iPhone 8 rumors at this point. Edge-to-edge display, camera and Touch ID integrated in the display, no home button, which I'm a little wonky about, wireless charging, one OLED, two standard, probably some sort of camera improvement in there. If you're thinking about buying a flagship phone and you're all about iOS, you might want to wait till this fall. Don't know what else to do.
As is the general recommendation 6 months after the release of the last one. Generally.
Cruel, harsh, but I think fundamentally fair. You guys, we talked a little bit about it last week, the OBT Open Bench Table. You guys got to finish your review of the Open Bench Table. It was the aluminum. It's gorgeous, and it's kind of trippy looking at it all set up.
I think it's trippy looking at it when it's not set up, because it is a single piece of aluminum that's been milled. And then like the legs are screwed in place with thumb screws that then become used for other parts. It's neat to see that it's one flat piece of thing that has a handle that all of the screws, all of the posts, all of the adapters, all the things that would normally go into it are all kind of attached to it very neatly and very cleanly. We did talk about it a little bit last week. So our summation of kind of our experiences with it were all very positive in that it sets up pretty well, relatively quickly for as many parts as it looks like there is. We had no compatibility issues, with the exception of our water cooling block on, I forget which Corsair H something we were using, one of the 120 mil, but double thick rads. It comes with these kind of elbow adapters, these angle adapters to attach them, and because of the placement of the res on the bottom of it, it was a little bit tighter and the screws weren't long enough to get through, so we kind of had to rotate something a different degree than we would normally otherwise. And the only other thing that kind of stood out was the power supply mounting. We had some people complain about the fact that the power supply is not mounted flat to the ground. It's kind of at an angle. You get like this slight gap between the edge of the power supply that mounts to the leg and the edge that is resting on the table. And that gap maybe put a little bit of fear in people's minds for how much torque was being put on anything at any given point. But we had no issues. We had it like that. And I would pick up the top part, the actual base of it, with the power supply attached, and I didn't feel like it was going to break. Like, the aluminum is very thick. The screws and attachments are steel. It didn't seem like there was any kind of problem in that regard. I loved the snap down motherboard mounts, the standoffs, and it's really nice looking as well.
Yeah.
The drawback is the price, right? It's close to $200. I think it is $200 with shipping. Depending on which color you get, they have a silver and kind of like a black and a red, maybe, I think, as well. It's expensive. And, you know, I think the usefulness of an open air system is debatable for the general consumer, right? Chances are people don't want this, right? You want it to be a little bit quieter and contained. Or if you're a person that just likes to have your components out on display, this is one way to do it.
Part of me, having spent a lot of time with systems built in an open fashion, just because it made it easier back in the day to swap GPUs or hard drives or whatever we were testing, I understand the appeal of it. And stylistically, you know, it's got a look. You either love that look or you hate that look. If you've never had an open case or just piled up a bunch of parts on a desk, if there's any kind of dust in your life, it will eventually settle all over the PC. And figuring out how to keep the dust from, you know, embedding itself permanently in dark corners that generate heat of the PC is always exciting. but I like it. You know, was this originally kind of put together towards the liquid nitrogen overclockers, or just everybody who spends a lot of time swapping parts?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. It's an open source design, which is interesting in that for two reasons. One, you can just download the plans, and if you happen to have access to an aluminum mill, you can just print this. Now, you don't have the hardware for it, but you can print it and cut it. If you have, you know, if you wanted to make it out of, you know, press wood or something like that, you could put the plans in a CNC mill, CNC machine, and print it out that way. It also allows you to, like, easily design accessories for it, right? If you want to 3D print accessories for this device, you have the plans with which to base them on. So it's pretty interesting, you know, in a lot of different ways. But as far as, you know, the LN2 guys, I mean, it kind of makes sense for them, as long as they have enough space for everything, and they don't have to worry about mounting water cooling hardware. But, you know, if you're doing overclocking, if you're doing frequent component swaps, which is what we do here, why they're useful, you know, I would love to replace all of our kind of cheap, crappy ones that we have with a bunch of these, as long as I'm willing to shell out the money. And the question is it worth the money to replace, I don't know, like a cardboard motherboard box? I don't know.
Depends on what you're bringing guests in.
Cardboard motherboard boxes are included with motherboard. So.
Harsh, but fair seems to be the theme of the show. you guys are having, you and Jeremy are headed to London to go see ARM. And there's going to be a meetup in London? Josh, I'm sorry.
Yes. So this is, I'm hoping that we have some readers or viewers and listeners in the London area. We are going to be there on April 27th at a hotel called the Cumberland Hotel. And inside of that, they have a bar called Momentous Bar. And we'll be hanging out from like 7:30 p.m. until whenever, probably midnight or later. It's sponsored by ARM, which means they're buying our drinks and stuff like that. But it's just a place for you if you guys want to come meet us and say hey and talk about technology or tell us how wrong we are about something. You have all the opportunity now to do that in person as opposed to over Twitter or email. And associated with that is a chance to win a couple of Chromebooks as well. The ones actually that I'm testing, the Acer Chromebook R13 and the Samsung Chromebook Plus. And you don't have to attend the event to enter the contest. That's kind of the secret. So if you go to that meetup story and can't be in London that day, then you can still enter to win the Chromebook device as well. But if you are in London, if you're within, you know, a reasonable range of there and you want to come out on April 27th, which is a Thursday night, and meet us and hang out, we would really love to see you guys there. So all right. That would be fun. Yeah.
A bright and cheerful thought there. Intel Developer Forum, not so cheerful. It's gone.
Yep.
And apparently nothing's going to replace it.
Apparently not. It's all very surprising to me. I thought it was my favorite show. It had changed quite a bit recently in terms of what kind of content they were showing. And, you know, in my opinion, it was getting a little worse because they were focusing more on, hey, look at our drone technology as opposed to here's our new microarchitecture. But it all seemed very correctable from the perspective of somebody who liked to attend it. It's disappointing. So I don't know. I don't really understand the reasons for it yet. It's not like they have money issues. But they basically said
that nobody uses desktops anymore.
Right, exactly. and to be clear, like, this wasn't something they said, oh, we're canceling it this year. They said we're canceling the show and the whole program because we don't feel like it fits with you know, the company mindset anymore, the company goals. And that we're going to address our messaging and education programs in other ways. So, I don't know. It seems like a very drastic move, but there you go.
Well, at this point, we just don't know. PeacePro.com, ladies and gentlemen, is the place to find Mr. Ryan Shrout, Mr. Alan Malventano. It is bad day for names for me saying them, apparently. I'd like to apologize to everyone whose name I said in today's episode or misidentified this episode. Man, PeacePro.com. You got a breather or another flurry of GPUs coming in the next week or two?
So I still have the RX 570 I want to finish. I got in a custom GTX 1080 Ti from EVGA I want to test. And then we talked about the Chromebooks that I'm trying to finish up and get some kind of synopsis on where I feel like the Android on Chrome OS ecosystem is. Ken's working on that Corsair One PC that we hope to have a review up sometime next week as well. So there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff coming. So,
oh man, we talked about Pi-holes versus OpenDNS this week. You joined us actually to talk about the Radeon RX 500 series of processors on TechThink. Thank you again for that. G14 review, and if you're into minimalist gaming environments, keep an eye on youtube.com/techthing next week, because Shannon did a complete, she basically has just made a better, calmer, zenner gaming environment or gaming setup on her system at home, and that should be a fun video. It's coming out Tuesday at youtube.com/techthing. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. To find all of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe, go to twit.tv/twitch. You can find Mr. Shrout at Ryan Shrout on the Twitter. I'm at Patrick Norton. PCPro.com, TechThing.com, AVXL.com are all great places to listen to more of what we do, because we love doing it for you. And hey, with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.